From Jefferson Public Radio, I'm Eric Thiel. Welcome to another JPR Live session. My guest today is out on tour in support of a new Greatest Hits collection, looking back at music released from 1970 to 2020 and a 50th anniversary. It is the legendary Bruce Cockburn. Hello, welcome.
Well, thank you. It's nice to be here with you.
It's an honor to have you here. I'm so glad you had time to drop by and visit with us.
I'm glad it worked out, yeah.
50 years. That's quite an achievement.
Yeah, and actually, I mean,
it's 50-ish.
It's 50-ish now. I mean, we were supposed to do the 50th anniversary tour in 2020, and as everyone knows, nothing happened in 2020. So, well, nothing of that sort. And so, you know, here we are making the second attempt at it. But it, you know, I mean, actually, the songs, even on the Greatest Hits collection that sort of goes with the tour. Songwriting started earlier than that, even so. Some of these songs date from the late 60s, and then they continue to up to 2020. But there's more since then now. Mm. So, you know, maybe we'll get to do a 100th anniversary someday. Who knows?
The collection's out on True North. You've been with them since the beginning.
Yeah. It started because I had been playing in bands, some of which were based in Yorkville, which was the Toronto equivalent of Haight-Ashbury. And I was acquainted with other musicians who were playing in similar bands. And one day I was sitting with a guy named Gene Martinek, who was a guitar player in another band. And I had left the bands that I was in, and I had decided I was going to do a solo thing. And his band had broken up, and he was kind of at odds, at loose ends. And so we're sitting there having a coffee one day, and I told him I really wanted to make an album. I had this fantasy in my mind that I felt choked up with the songs I'd written. I had a bunch of stuff. Most of it, you know, with hindsight, was terrible, and I'm glad no one ever will hear it. But some of it was okay, and I had this little body of work that I really liked when I played it myself, and that's why I went solo in the first place. But I wanted to record it so I could make room in my brain for new songs. I felt I was kind of being choked up with this stuff, and Gene, I told Gene this, and Gene said, well, you know, I want to be a record producer. I want to get into that. And I said, well, this sounds good to me. I wanted to make an album that was like the albums of the kind of one aspect of the music that was my model for music was the old blues guys, Mississippi John Hurt, mm-hmm. Mance Lipscomb, people like that, and Bill Brunsey. And I wanted to make an album like the ones they made, which was just a guy singing and playing the guitar and nobody putting strings on it or any of that stuff. And, I mean, there's some beautiful albums like that too, but that isn't what I wanted to do. And at the time, the people I knew who were getting to make records were heavily influenced by whoever was producing to make it sort of smooth and, not even radio friendly back then, because in the early days of FM radio, radio friendly was everything. I didn't want to do that. So we talked about this, and Gene said, well, you know, Bernie Finkelstein, who used to manage the band he'd been in, wants to start a record label. And he and I were talking about that. And so let me go, you know, we'll talk to Bernie about this and see if we can make something out of it. And so Gene brought Bernie down to hear me play a gig, and Bernie liked what he heard, and he also liked the fact that I wanted to make a record that wouldn't cost anything, and he went out and found some money, and we made the first True North album, which was my first album, just called Bruce Cockburn, and we recorded it in 3 days, and put it out a month later.
Wow,
it's not like that now, but you know, and that was the beginning of the whole thing. So,
do you have an idea at this point of how many songs you've actually written?
Oh, you know, somewhere over 300. I don't really know. There's probably 50 or 60 songs from the mid to early 60s that should never be heard. and then there's everything that's been recorded since then. Yeah. So, you know, I don't know really.
And so if it's roughly 300-ish, the very top 10% is what has ended up on this greatest hits collection. You've referred to them as a combination of radio chart hits, fan favorites, requests. How did you pick? What was the criteria that you used for this collection?
It was really simple, actually. We put everything that we'd ever released as a single on there. You know, I mean, no, we don't talk about singles nowadays, but you still aim songs at radio. And so it's those songs that were considered. I mean, actually on one occasion we actually recorded a song that was supposed to be, quote, a single, unquote. That was in the 80s, the early 80s, when it was very fashionable to be doing that sort of thing. And we recorded a song called Coldest Night of the Year and put it out that way. Mm. It subsequently ended up on a record. But initially it was just itself being released. And unfortunately, we recorded it, early in the year of whatever year it was. And it didn't come out until spring, so nobody wanted to play a record called Coldest Night of the Year as summer was coming on. But it's had seasonal action ever since, you know, on radio, and which is kind of a nice thing. And, you know, when it starts to feel wintry, people start playing that song. But otherwise, the songs were drawn from albums. The first album, it was a song called Going to the Country that went to radio, and some stations played it, others did not, and it wasn't really until the end of the 70s in Canada that I had a song that was played so much that it became a national hit. There were songs that got popular in certain regions of the country before that. There's a song on the second album called One Day I Walk that was also like that, and it was just, we'd look at the songs, I'd look at an album and then think, well, what's likely to get played, and send that to radio.
Well, I'm kind of hoping you'll aim one our direction. Will you play us something today?
I'd be happy to.
Bruce Coburn is my guest live in the studio. His new collection of music is called simply Greatest Hits, 1970 to 2020. You can find information at his website, brucecoburn.com. All right, what do you want to play first?
Well, that's a good question. We could do it in chronological order, or we can mix it up. I mean,
you're the guest of honor.
All right, well, then let's go chronological. This is one of the oldest of the songs I can currently execute. My canoe lies on the water. Evening holds the bones of day. The sun, like gold dust, slips away. One by one, antique stars herald the arrival of their pale protectress. Ragged branches vibrate, strummed by winds from o'er the hill. Singing tales of ancient days. Far and silent lightning stirs the cauldron of the sky.
I turn my bow toward the
That is called Let Us Go Laughing. Bruce Coburn is my guest live in the studio today, playing music from a wonderful new collection called Greatest Hits 1970 to 2020, though that tune not on it.
No, it was never sent to radio, and it was, I mean, no one ever imagined that it would get airplay. And
well, it just did.
It just did. There you go. Hey. If you wait long enough, you know. But it was. It did get to be popular with a certain segment of the population, the canoeing crowd.
The canoeing crowd.
Yeah, and there is such a thing. I mean, the various sports, of course, have their various adherents, and in Canada, in particular, canoeing is a fairly popular pastime, and it was. The song was sort of embraced by a bunch of people who were into that, and I actually was reminded of it because of this is going to get pretty esoteric for an American audience, but in Canadian art history, there's something called the Group of Seven, and the Group of Seven was a bunch of painters. There was an intentional sort of collective in a way. I mean, they didn't operate exactly collectively, but they affiliated themselves with each other for their own support and kind of to promote the notion of Canadian painting that wasn't derivative from the European colonial base, kind of. So they painted were landscapes mainly, they were really good painters, and we're talking now in the early 1900s, and there's a gallery in Ontario called the McMichael Gallery that shows primarily that work of these seven artists, and they were doing a book putting out a book a couple of years ago of the Group of Seven's work and celebrating it and soliciting writings about those painters from various people, and I was one of them. And then for the release of the book, because the guy I chose to write about, Tom Thompson, was an avid canoeist and painted a lot of scenes involving the canoe or in scenes of things that he could only get to with a canoe. And he was closely associated with that. So you know, I had written about this, and then they said, well, we're going to do a sort of gala release of the book, and I mean, it's all virtual, of course, at this point, but we'd like you to record Let Us Go Laughing for the, that event. And I hadn't thought about doing the song for decades, but I went back and listened to it. I thought, yeah, you know, I can relate to this. So that brought it back to mind, and I've kind of been, had it in the repertoire ever since.
For folks who have followed you through the years and listened to your music, they might be surprised to learn that you actually studied jazz composition.
I did.
Do you think jazz didn't stick?
Oh, it stuck, but not as a player. I'm just not good enough.
Yeah, is that what it was?
Well, it was partly. It wasn't only that. I think that's a truth, but I think that I could have probably got better at it had I persisted. But I went to music school for a couple of years. After high school, I enrolled in a program that was a 4-year Bachelor of Music program at Berklee College of Music in Boston. And I went there for a year and a half, and I really learned a lot, and I really enjoyed being there in certain ways, and certainly as a musical experience, it was really valuable. Not just the school, which was that, but also the Boston folk scene that was active at the time, and there were all these great people came through town, and I got to hear them, and the great jazz people. I mean, there was a jazz club around the corner from where I lived that had weekly matinees so that you could go in underage and, you know, listen to the music. And, you know, I got to see John Coltrane from about 3 feet away. I got, you know, it's a little jazz club. Coltrane, Eric Dolphy, I mean, all these incredible players of that era. You know, I've never lost my love for that music or an interest in an affinity, I guess, for the sound and the kind of creative space that music occupies. And but somewhere along the way, I was also at the same time listening to songwriters and listening to the old blues guys, you know, that I was learning to fingerpick from listening to. The stuff I was studying, when you studied composition, you had to have an instrument, of course, too, and guitar was my instrument. But what they were teaching me there was, you know, basically jazz guitar.
Yeah.
And I remember some of the stuff, but I never really got very good at executing it, and the jazz of the time, the stuff that appealed to me was the stuff that didn't rely so much on complicated chord changes. That's what I liked, and it's what I could sort of grasp how to play. But the stuff they wanted you to learn was like old, you know, swing into bebop and complicated music and very demanding technically. And I just wasn't up to it. But I also felt this pull towards songwriting. I'd always loved poetry, and I was trying to write poetry on the side too, you know, and then at some point it occurred to me, you should try putting those two things together. And and I realized that...
How's that worked out for you?
Well, fairly well, actually. Thank you. One day I just realized that it built up over time, that I had to drop out of music school, and I didn't know what was going to happen. It was just a voice inside was going, this is not for you. You've got to be doing something else now. And so I dropped out, and the something else at first was a rock band that my friends in Ottawa, Canada, were putting together. And that band lasted about a year, and they, you know, morphed into something else, and some, you know, there was another band and so on. So the first half of the 60s was all about those bands.
So what was it that caused you to kind of set the band part of your musical life behind? Was it the singular vision of wanting to associate the poetry with the music that you were creating and kind of have a singular voice in what you were saying?
It developed over time. At first I was happy to be in any band and just fun to play music. And the first band, I wasn't even playing guitar. I was playing keyboards because I was the only guy among the group of us that knew how to do that at all. I don't now, but I did then. You know, I was playing this horrible Farfisa organ. that kind of organ comes into its own when you're listening to an Italian movie with an Ennio Morricone score, but anything else, it just sounds like garbage. So, although it's probably, somebody could make something out of it now in the days of electronica and everything, but that's what I played. And then the next band, I was the guitar player again. But I was writing songs for all these different bands, you know, well, all these, maybe three or four different bands that I was in over time. And the songwriting evolved, and you know, I felt like I was getting better at it. And I eventually ended up with this small pool of material that I really liked, but that sounded better when I played it alone. And I, you know, between that and just the difficulties of being a fledgling band and never having enough to eat and never having, you know, just scuffling all the time, struggling and disagreements over where the music should go and all this sort of stuff, all of that conspired to make me feel like I just wanted to go solo.
Does playing music still give you the same sense of joy that it gave you then?
At times it does.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sometimes it just feels like terrifying, and sometimes it feels like a lot of work. But a lot of the time there's times, and it's not dependent on whether an audience is present or not. I mean, it's more fun to play songs in front of people because it's nice when somebody's on the other end of it, you know. But there's a certain quality, it comes most often when I'm improvising. You kind of get transported into a timeless place.
Yeah.
And that can happen with an audience present or not. I mean, it just sort of, it's momentary, or okay, not momentary, it lasts longer than that, but it's occasional, let's say. It doesn't always happen.
Bruce Cockburn is my guest today, live in the studio. He's out on tour in support of a new Greatest Hits release called Greatest Hits 1970 to 2020 and a 50th anniversary tour. Information on Bruce and his musical legacy at brucecockburn.com. Well, how does playing on the radio sound? Can you play us something else?
Yeah. Playing on the radio at this moment sounds just fine.
Great.
This is I guess we could call it a middle-aged song. This is from the early 80s, and it's one of the songs that actually was a sort of hit. This is Lovers in a Dangerous Time.
The hours grow shorter as the days go by. You never get to stop and open your eyes. One day you're waiting for the sky to fall. The next you're dazzled by the beauty of it all. When you're a lover in a dangerous time, lovers in a dangerous time. These fragile bodies of touch and taste, this vibrant skin, this hair like lace. Spirits open to the thrust of grace. Never a breath you can afford to waste. When you're lovers in a dangerous time, lovers in a dangerous time. When you're lovers in a dangerous time, lovers in a dangerous time. Thank you. when your lover's in a dangerous time. Sometimes you're made to feel as if your love's a crime. But nothing worth having comes without some kind of fight. Got to kick at the darkness till it bleeds daylight. When your lover's in a dangerous time. Lover's in a dangerous time. When your lover's in a dangerous time. Lover's in a dangerous time.
That was fantastic. It's what an honor to be here. Thanks for doing this.
Oh, thank you.
Bruce Coburn is playing for us today live in the studio. His new album out on True North Records is a greatest hits collection, chronicling 50 years of songwriting and recording, 1970 to 2020. Information is at brucecoburn.com. So back in, 2014, you released a memoir.
Yes.
Rumors of Glory.
Yeah.
How would you rate the memoir and this greatest hits collection in terms of the best description of who you are?
You're going to get more information in the book. I mean, obviously it's about words. So I think that in a way, the album and the book would complement each other. Mm-hmm. The story arc, such as it is, of the book is kind of hung on the songs. I got into doing it because I got an invitation from the publishers, HarperCollins, to come to do this book. And I met with the editor and a couple of other people from the company in a bar on Haight Street in San Francisco, and they made me an offer. They said, we want you to write a spiritual memoir, and we're going to give you this much money to do it.
Hmm.
And this is, at the time, I'd been approached with similar offers in the past, but it always seemed too soon. I didn't feel like I had enough of a story to tell, and I'd been approached by other people who wanted to write my biography, and I felt like it was my story to tell, but I didn't really want to hand it over to somebody else. So this offer came at a good time, and I thought, yeah, you know what? I've got enough behind me now that I can say something about things. They said, the mandate was to write what they called a spiritual memoir.
Hmm.
I asked them what that meant, and they said they didn't know, but I was going to come up with it. So, so what you get with the book is what, you know, what I considered to be a spiritual memoir. One of my friends told me that's not a spiritual memoir, but I think it is, and it's structured a lot around the songs, around the songs that are sort of spiritually oriented of mine, and some other ones too. I mean, the ones that are well known are in there because they're part of the story. So the book is a lot about how those songs came to be written, and how they fit into the framework of my life, basically. What that means is it's a different selection of songs than what you get on the Greatest Hits package. But I think the Greatest Hits spans the same time period, and some of them, there is some overlap. Of course, a song like If I Had a Rocket Launcher is talked about a lot in the book, and it's on the Greatest Hits album.
Yeah.
But, for instance, I think they'd fit together well.
Hmm. Greatest hits can sometimes point to there being a finish line in the future or in the near future. You're still actively writing songs.
Yeah, so far, yeah. I mean, stuff keeps coming out. I don't take it for granted, I'll tell you that. And I never have, actually. I mean, it always seemed to me like, okay, I've got an album worth of songs. Let's get the album done and get it in the can in case that's the end of it, you know?
Are they different kinds of songs now? I mean, are there things that you can play or sing now that you couldn't 30 years ago, or things that you could sing or play 30 years ago that you can't now?
Yes. Yes to both. I mean, my hands won't execute some of the stuff I could play 30 years ago, 40, 50 years ago. I mean, I've got, you know, arthritic fingers and they get stiff and there's certain things they won't do. But I can play most of my songs, but a few things I've had to let go of. And on the other end of that, I think my songwriting is more sophisticated now than it was when I started. I mean, I think if you compare individual songs at various points, that would be harder to see. But if you see them as a kind of as a whole sweep, you would see a difference over the passage of years.
Hmm. I've enjoyed chatting with you. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me. Hmm. Nice to be with you.
Bruce Cockburn is my guest. His new album is A Greatest Hits Collection, 1970 to 2020. It's out on True North Records. You can find information at brucecockburn.com. Well, I can't quite see it from where I stand, and you've got a capo on the headstock, so I can't tell. What is it that you're playing in the studio today?
This guitar is a Callings. It's a company based in Austin that is a very good guitar maker. I've had and do have a number of guitars. But this is the one that was most convenient and workable for this occasion.
All right. So you got one more in it for today?
Yeah. Well, we've done a very old and a middle age, and so this is going to be something very new.
Breakfast was Mahler and coffee. Dinner's Lightning, Hopkins, and rye. Everything you say comes back to bite you. These days only beauty makes you cry. If the chapel is closed for the COVID, black mold owns the city by the sea. Dew beaded cobweb in the moonlight. A halo for a saint who's yet to be. And the dead shall sing to the living and the semi-alive. Three-legged canine, backbone creaking like a cheap shoe, dragging the accretions of a lifetime. But you ought to make another mile or two, and the dead shall sing to the living and the semi-alive. Dead shall sing to the living and the semi-alive. Bells will ring when you arrive. When you
A brand new tune there for Bruce Cockburn. He's my guest live in the studio today. His new record is called Greatest Hits 1970 to 2020. It's out on True North Records. You can find information at brucecockburn.com. Bruce, it's been an honor. Thanks again.
Thank you.
We'll have audio from our session today up on the web later at ijpr.org. Open air continues in just a minute.